who we view as the most authoritative and electable is rooted in systems of oppression.
There are so many inequities around having our experts in our community speak about our work.
Obviously, there are several facets to this strangely homogenous nature of the electoral system.
And to be left out of conversations, it only exemplifies that loss of self-esteem.
You're listening to Conversations, live panel discussions hosted by CITR's Spoken Word Collectives.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to CITR at 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory. Thanks for tuning into today's episode of Intersection, CITR's bi-weekly radio show about intersectional feminism, gender empowerment, and bringing down the patriarchy, all of which are in a day's work for the small but powerful team here at CITR. We air every other Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m., so make sure you tune in for some woke conversations and content. My name is Lakshmi.
And my name is Sarah. We're going to be moderating today's panel discussion on race and representation in the electoral system. Last month, The Straight noted that no one from Vancouver's three largest racialized communities, Chinese, South Asian, and Filipinos, were elected to Vancouver City Council in 2018. There's also never been a Vancouver councillor who has traced their roots back to Punjab, Vietnam, the Philippines, Africa, the Middle East, or Latin America.
The hashtag #CouncilSoWhite has been kind of raging on Twitter since yesterday, and it's really just another symptom of Vancouver's political and social zeitgeist. One of the big controversial stories coming out of Vancouver is the election of a nearly all-white council, with the exception of Pete Fry, who's of mixed-race heritage. Vancouver has also never had a person of color or woman elected as mayor, which I think is pretty crazy considering just how diverse we pride Vancouver for being. Joining us live in the studio now are three enormously talented people. We have Ellen Woodsworth, who's a former Vancouver City Councillor, in addition to being the founder of Women Transforming Cities International Society. We also have Kimberly Wong, who's a climate action and social justice activist and is currently majoring in geography at UBC. And last but not least, we have Alex Lloyd, who's a political science master's student at UBC. So some people are saying that the discussion of race and representation is really just a part of identity politics. To suggest that race and diversity are the most important aspect of any elected body is illogical, so to speak, according to them. And they argue that ethnic backgrounds don't necessarily have anything to do with the qualifications or prowess of the candidates themselves. So I guess my question to you guys is, should the quality of the candidates, the platforms they've been elected on, the issues they'll tackle in office, their leadership, be more important than the color of their skin, their gender, or their sexuality? What do you guys think about that?
I think that that's been, this is Kimberly speaking, I think that that's been a popular critique of people saying that there needs to be more representation on Vancouver City Council. I'd also just like to say that it's really important for us to ground this discussion in a land acknowledgement, given that we're going to be talking about things like systemic oppression, and colonialism is the ultimate systemic oppression. But yeah, my colleague Melody Ma released an article first on Medium, and then it was published by the Taiyi, and that was the most popular critique. People who were saying, I would just rather vote for somebody based on their policies. I don't see color. And I think that in order for us to have a productive conversation, it's important for us to ground this in the fact that, yes, representation is important, but people of color, and if we're talking particularly about women of color, we are more than just women of color. We are diverse folks who have all sorts of political inclinations, who have diverse backgrounds, diverse ancestries, and come with a diverse set of experiences.
I think the question is being posed falsely by those people who are making those statements. We know that class and race and income and diversity and indigeneity go absolutely together with who gets elected, who the parties are, where the money flows from. So the fact that there's so, that Pete Fry is the only person on council who is identified with any diversity is just an example of what's happened in also in Toronto and Ottawa. And if you look at, you combine gender with diversity, this is the first time that we've ever had more than 50% women on council. We've only had 50% of women in council twice in the 125 years of the colonialization of this land. And, you know, I always have to say there was an Indigenous woman, Angie Todd Dennis, who ran for mayor of Vancouver, and there's nothing named after her. There's no recognition of her. So to say that you can't look at, you don't look at race when you vote is part of a white supremacist attitude. And you can't separate gender, race from your income level. So I think this is just the beginning of a discussion that Nikki Sharma started on the Georgia Strait. And if you look at the thread after that, it was viciously white supremacist and so full of ignorance. It was just staggering. And very few people, it was so frightening that you get a sense of why people don't run for elected office because of the nastiness of the attacks from a very clearly written article that she'd done in the Georgia Strait.
Yeah, just adding on to those comments, this is Alex, by the way, who we view as the most authoritative and electable is rooted in systems of oppression, right? It is rooted in this white supremacist narrative as well, and that comes out as well in not only who we choose to have as seen as electable by, say, parties and choosing candidates, but also in terms of media coverage is often highly racialized, highly gendered in terms of the discussion of respectability politics and tone policing, in particular with racialized and gendered minorities.
Sorry, I have to call you on that one. It's not, they're not majorities. Women are, we are not a majority. The Asian community in Vancouver is not a minority. And that's part of the false narrative, too, that we have to confront.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, so the Institute for Research on Public Policy published a brief paper in its Policy Options Journal this week under the headline, Elections in Canada, in some of Canada's most diverse cities, still produced extremely homogenous councils. This threatens the legitimacy of their decisions. I'm interested in the legitimacy part. Do you think that it's true? Is the lack of diversity, of diverse representation, undermining the legitimacy of our municipal political system?
Yes, absolutely. Because when people don't see themselves elected in the council or in the provincial legislature or in the federal level, they step away from elected office, which means they don't have the ability to create cities that reflect and meet the needs of all of their citizens. It's a critical part that women have clearly faced for a lot of time. And but the fact we don't even recognize the land that we are based on, Indigenous people, and the phenomenal violence that Indigenous women face in this city can't be addressed unless the people who are facing it are at the table and talking about it.
My next question is for you, Ellen, but it's also open to the rest of the panel, of course. It's open to you specifically because you're not only a former Vancouver City Councillor, but it's my understanding that you were also the first openly lesbian city councillor in all of Canada. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like there's an extra burden on women who run in campaigns? And by that I mean, do women have to present or market themselves differently in order to not only be more successful candidates, but also appear, for lack of a better word, more competent, if not more competent, than their male, usually white male counterparts?
Yes, and in Vancouver, where we don't have a ward system, most cities in North America have ward systems, so women can include their unpaid work and their volunteer work on their resume. So in Vancouver, first of all, you have to find a party that will invite you in to run with them and actually win the nomination. So often that requires money, it requires, you know, either you know where a good Sally Ann is or you know someone who can trust you. You need to have the childcare support if you've got kids. You need to withstand the nastiness and the personal attacks that you'll face. Nikki Sharma was elected to Parks Board, and then she was chair of Parks Board, and then she ran for council. And the attacks that she experienced as a woman of South Asian descent were vicious. I mean, we're having her speak at our AGM on Sunday. But Angie Todd-Nednes, how is it possible that an Indigenous woman who ran for mayor of Vancouver is completely invisible today? You know, so you're dealing with both the things aren't said about you and the things that the attacks that you are facing. And if you're adding to that intersectionality being queer, it's tough. You have to have a lot of support and really be aware that you're running from the people and with the people and working for the people once you're elected to be able to withstand being in that public venue. And given the attacks on social media these days, a lot of women are deciding not to run.
Sorry, I want to speak directly to that, speaking specifically about tokenism, actually. So you were talking about how she was the first Indigenous woman to run as the mayor of Vancouver, as a candidate, right? Political parties are guilty of things like tokenism. This slates women of color, for example, as shelled of their entirety as purely identities, and particularly ones that make people look inclusive. So I'll use myself. I check a lot of boxes. I'm queer. I'm a young person. I'm a person of color. I'm a fifth generation Chinese Canadian woman, and I have felt the bounds of this tokenism quite a bit. And I think I was thinking about the midterm elections and how these things were represented, the midterm elections in the United States. So Ocasio-Cortez was, quote-unquote, the youngest. Ilhan Omar was the first Muslim in a particular state to win. Stacey Abrams was the first Black person. Katie Hill was the first openly bisexual. And on the other hand, young Kim appeared as the first Korean-American, even though she campaigned as a Republican and has openly said homophobic and transphobic things in the media. So the point I'm trying to make is that these women have policies and stances and histories beyond what we present them as, and not acknowledging them is doing a disservice to their work and actual diversity. And also on the point of Pete Fry, there has been a tremendous amount of pressure that has been put on Pete Fry alone as the single person of color on city council, and I think that's troubling. So it was almost as if suddenly it was Pete Fry's job alone to represent the entirety of people of color in the city of Vancouver. And I think that, like these women mentioned above, Pete Fry has a complex set of experiences and values that make him who he is, whether or not he's the one being currently looked to for guidance on how to govern over a city that is more than half people of color.
Yeah, so he's actually commented that he doesn't feel that his like ethnic ambiguity necessarily allows him to represent the lived experiences of Vancouver's large, visibly minority population. So we actually wanted to ask, I guess, about that tokenism that you were describing and whether minority candidates, whether it's in terms of like their race, their gender, or their sexuality, feel this added pressure as minorities to represent their demographic in their campaign and while they're in office.
Well, yeah.
really, really, really good points. I just want to correct myself to say that I totally supported Angie Todd-Nednes because she was a long time Red Power activist, still is, and lives in Vancouver, and she's amazingly strong and able woman who ran for COPE, for the mayor of COPE. So, we do have to look at the complexities and not the... It's important to identify the roots of a person's struggle, because if we just elect someone who's a woman and she's anti-women, which is often the way women get to power, is that they're anti-women and they play into the male scenario to get there.
I call them Margaret Thatchers.
Margaret Thatcher, who kept making her hair more and more and more blonde.
Yeah, sort of the way it's conceptualized in a lot of literature and political science is this difference between a descriptive representation and an actual substantive representation. Mm-hmm. And the descriptive is sort of what you're getting at when you're discussing this tokenism, this, we have a gender-based cabinet. But when you actually look at the policies and the positions within the ministry, it's not equitable in terms of the allotment of power. And I think that that's also another important point to consider. And also, yeah, it's so hard from one positionality, from one lived experience, to represent a completely diverse group of people. And I feel like a lot of the times how we see these campaigns manifest is sort of flattening and homogenizing a lived experience of a group of people that is so diverse and changing.
Yeah, like someone like Trudeau, it's well known as a feminist. And I'm glad that he says that, and I'm glad he's putting more money into international affairs for women. But if you look at the millions he spends for women, and you compare it to the billions he's spending on armaments, what does it mean he's a feminist if it's the overwhelming majority of the budget is going to defense?
Yeah, and it's sort of like the Margaret Thatcher point. Like, what does it really matter that you're a woman if your politics are exclusionary to most working class racialized women?
Well, it does matter that we have equally right to be horrible right wing people, but it's not equity. It's not gonna make the world a better place for all women. So there's that confusion, I think.
I just wanted to touch on, I have, when thinking about, like, representation in politics, I've kind of struggled with this idea of tokenization and meaningful representation and almost a chicken and egg question of, like, do we need to have, like, let's say, Trudeau's cabinet quota, where we have a set number of positions that need to be filled by women? Do those sort of policies need to come first and then be followed by meaningful representation? Or do, I guess, we go the other way where we build from meaningful representation first, and then we won't even need the quotas?
I think you're talking about affirmative action and diversity quotas. So I think that those are a good first step and very tactile things that people can implement. But I don't think that those are the bounds by which we can make meaningful changes in ways that don't tokenize people as shells of their identities.
We wouldn't have the so-called affirmative action if we didn't have a strong women's movement, the Me Too movement, the It's Time, the, you know, Black Lives Matter, et cetera. We wouldn't have him doing things like that if it hadn't been on the backs of our struggles. And in India, there's legislation that 1/3 of all municipal electives must be women. And yeah, in the beginning, maybe they were somebody's wife or sister or aunt or whatever, but that was the equality, that there was the role modeling. And now in Kerala, it's 50%. And women are learning those skills, learning how to be in leadership positions and bringing forward the issues of women. So everybody says, oh, we can't have affirmative action. I don't actually agree, because we haven't moved forward. 60% of mayors are women. And if you break that down in terms of Indigenous women mayors in Canada, we're like 39th in the world. We're not moving ahead, even though supposedly economically we're a fairly well-off country. So I say yes to affirmative action.
Yeah, and I think it's also important. I think a lot of the discourse around affirmative action and quotas from certain political sides wants to position affirmative action as the end goal when it really is not, right? Like, mm-hmm. affirmative action mm-hmm. is the first step towards changing a political culture to be more accepting and to allow for a diversity of opinions and positionalities within it, right? So we should not conceptualize affirmative action as our end goal for equality or representation.
You're listening to CITR at 101.9 FM. Thank you for tuning into Intersections. We've been talking about the lack of diversity in Vancouver City Council so far, and we're joined by a panel of Ellen Woodsworth, Kimberly Wong, and Alex Lloyd.
So, Kimberly, I know that you're working right now on the proportional representation referendum that's happening in BC, and bringing awareness about it. I actually just moved here from Toronto, I guess like 2 months ago, so I have not been as quite tuned in to the issue as I probably should and want to be. So if you could give us a little background and then maybe talk about it, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I would love to. I support proportional representation. So for folks who are just tuning in, proportional representation is up for votes right now. There's a referendum happening in British Columbia that goes on until November 30th. And we're voting on whether or not we want to keep first past the post or switch to something called proportional representation, and there are three systems that you can vote for. The group that I'm organizing with, we're calling ourselves Subtle Pro-Rep Traits, and we're a group of Asian youth, about 15 people, organizing to bring these messages to our communities, because a lot of the messaging that has been out there is specifically slated towards white Anglo communities, and a lot of the folks who are organizing around this are men. So representation, super important. We equated in these little pamphlets that we made wasted votes with wasted food, which I think resonates with a lot of like aunties and also my own family. So we wanted something that gave them a base understanding of what electoral reform is, and what this matters to for our communities as well. Mm-hmm. And just letting you know, you can find this pamphlet and any further information on the Hua Foundation Facebook. That's HUA Foundation.
Cool. Thank you, Kimberly. Speaking of wasted votes, another important thing that came out of this time's council elections is the issue of voter apathy. CBC News noted that only 39% of Vancouverites voted. That still leaves a shocking 61% of eligible voters that just didn't vote. So obviously there are several facets to this strangely homogenous nature of the electoral system. And I don't think racism or some kind of weird aversion to anglicized surnames is the only issue. There seems to be something about the very structure of the system that's keeping it so homogenous, which might in turn be responsible for voter apathy. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is this system that's cementing a certain demographic as the dominant representation in mayoral and councillor candidates, it's obviously dissuading minorities from actively voting or having their votes matter to begin with. And Sarah, you spoke to Terry Glavin.
I read Terry Glavin. I did not speak to him. But he and several other people have also argued that voter apathy is a more important issue than the quote-unquote color of the council. Voter apathy and turnout is definitely a major issue in our representative democracies, but I disagree with the idea that voter apathy and the demographic makeup of the council are somehow two separate issues. So I guess we just want to know, what are your thoughts?
Women Transforming Cities put out the Hot Pink Paper municipal campaign, and one of the 11 issues we said that could make Vancouver a women-friendly city was electoral reform, and we called for all the parties to put at least 50% of their candidates as diverse women, and that we needed electoral reform. We needed wards so people could run with outside of parties, and there was one other thing, support the City for All Women's Equity Strategy and the Women's Advisory Committee. But people aren't apathetic. People don't feel like they have any power or any say. And when they feel that way, then why should they vote? And when, you know, we should be voting the voting age to 16 and get people engaged in high school, because they say if you can get someone to vote when they're younger, then they'll keep voting. But I think that this city is a very diverse city, but when you don't see it represented in council, and when the parties aren't actively seeking candidates who represent the diverse background of the Indigenous people or a strong, 39% plus Asian background, then why would people want to get out and vote? So that's not apathetic. That's, I'd say, fury, walking away saying, well, you don't represent us. You don't care to represent us. So why should we vote? But in the end, we're cutting off our nose to spite our face, I think. And by the way, proportional representation has shown to increase the number of women elected by at least 8%, and increase diversity. And I don't have the number, I haven't seen the numbers on that, but it definitely does increase representation across the board. Mm-hmm.
There's really good examples all around the world for that, but particularly with regards to New Zealand, and particularly talking about an Indigenous representation in government, there are really, really good examples of proportional representation yielding higher rates of Indigenous folks on government.
Yeah.
Almost to the point where they had seats delegated for Indigenous folks, and there have been so many folks elected that are Indigenous that they don't need those seats anymore. Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, I know that Kimberly and Ellen, you guys do a lot of work in like getting people out to vote and raising awareness. And I'm just wondering, what other things can we do other than like electoral reform and things more in the civil society, civic participation sphere, where we can, like as you were saying, kind of channel that fury instead of cutting off our noses to spite our faces to actually participating in the system?
Organize, organize, organize.
But organize in ways that resonate with people.
Yes.
So for example, the group that I'm working with, Subtle Pro Rep Traits, we are putting out memes that have been really being received well by younger folks and folks who haven't engaged with the political system in the same ways as, I guess, Ellen and I and Alex do regularly.
Yeah, I think it's very important. We're watching what's happening in the United States with the rise of the right wing, but we also saw that CAC, which is a very right-wing government, won the Quebec elections, and Doug Ford won the Ontario elections. So we have to come together with each other in our demonstrations and in our social movements, but we also have to create electoral parties. We've got the chance to vote for pro-rep, which clearly is in our interest. There's a federal election coming up in less than a year. We need to be organized in small groups and in large groups to get our platforms out there, to get our candidates out there who will stand for us and make sure that we win the next election with representation that can stand up to a very, very well-funded right wing.
Okay, I want to pivot a little bit and talk about something that we mentioned. We kind of touched upon this with the U.S. midterm elections, but wait, where am I going with this? Oh, no, so... I have a question, and it's just going in multiple different directions. But when we were doing research, I actually noticed we touched upon this earlier. We did in that over, I think it's 8 of the 10 counselors who are elected are women. Mm-hmm. But as we were saying, all of them are white. And something that I have been kind of following through the U.S. elections, I don't know what the status of this in Canada is the, I want to say, choice by a lot of white women to choose their race over their gender. And so I'm just wondering, I don't even know if there's a real question that comes out of this, but like, how do we reconcile this progress that we've clearly made with the representation of women on city council with that distinct lack of progress that we've made with the representation of people of color and the friction between representation by white women for that has come to represent like women as a whole, I guess. I don't know if there was a question there. Thoughts?
I think that there's, you know, capitalism is very successful about splitting us up. They use images of two gay men walking down the street to get people to join banks. They don't usually do lesbian couples doing much that I've seen.
No, we're fiercely underrepresented.
So you know, we've seen how black people are used as a marketing campaigns. So clearly, the intersectionality of our lives will be used against us at certain times, and yet it's a way we can work with each other. And so just as we were talking earlier about equity, you know, it's was incredibly important that Obama and Michelle were elected to the White House. But in fact, he got America involved with a couple more wars. The income level of black people in the States went down. And they were all, you know, so we have to be as creative as the people who own the majority of the wealth in the world, which is like, I think there's 16% of people in the States are millionaires, but how many people have you know, are sleeping on the streets. So our organizing has to reflect our full diversity, and we have to be really, that's why we're a non-party organization. I haven't been a member of any parties for about 5 years or more, because we wanted to have a clear position on gender intersectionality in terms of the full platform to do with transit, electoral reform, childcare, violence, affordable housing. You know, all of these things go into any platform that are really going to advance our issues in a way that actually changes the pie. The pie doesn't work. It doesn't work for men. It doesn't work for women. It doesn't work for diversity of any sort. We actually have to create a new way of moving forward, and that has to be reflected in our social justice movements. And we're still really not seeing that.
I want to talk particularly about organizing, because we keep on emphasizing the importance of that. But we're talking about the term intersectionality a lot, and it was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, who was a Black feminist scholar, who created the term intersectionality to empower women, particularly Black women, who face different things than other folks, right? And so this term was used to empower her own community, organizers of a community empowering their own community. So questions of how we empower, for example, women of color, truly empowering them is difficult. Do people have the resources to have a wide enough spread? Are there people leading this charge that have actual lived experiences in what they have preaching or that they're empowering? Do they have the capacity to understand or comprehend different cultures? Do they have the competency to understand the diversity of genders that exist in this world, of intersectionality? Do they understand the power of storytelling or story exploration, et cetera?
Yeah, and also like one step before empowerment, but also just describing the forms of oppression that different identities face, right? I think that's what's so important and impactful about having an intersectional analysis, is that you need to recognize that these intersections affect different people in different ways. So the policy solutions that may benefit a white woman would affect a Black woman differently, or perhaps even marginalize her. And I'm not super surprised to hear this statistic that it's all white women on the council. I'm a transplant from Ontario myself, so I'm getting caught up on electoral politics out here in Vancouver. But usually it is white women, myself included, who advocate for that sort of, get that representation first, right? Because of our race. And I think when you look at something like the fact that the majority of white women in the United States voted for Donald Trump, I think you have to look at the fact that white supremacy is still within a lot of white women's movements and white women's organizing, and that is why we need to make space for different forms of knowledge and different voices, because those white women that voted for Donald Trump, even though he was saying very vulgar things and he's been accused of being a sexual predator and he is very anti-woman, were voting for him on the basis partially of their race, because their race cushioned how they understood and experienced their misogyny that they experience in their everyday life, and as well as their class background as well. If you break it down by socioeconomic stratification, wealthier women also tended to vote for Donald Trump. So I don't know where I was going with that overall, but more so I think that there needs to be an acknowledgement of making sure that as white women we are not speaking for others, and instead taking a step back and allowing others to have that space instead.
So I guess kind of switching gears a little bit, and I guess I sort of posing this question to you, Kimberly, how do we get, I mean, earlier I was talking to one of my friends and she mentioned that she voted for the first time for the elections, but none of her friends did. they just like could not be bothered to vote. They were just too lazy or the system was too complicated. And I feel like a lot of people of color and millennials, I think, may feel similarly in terms of it just being too much of a hassle. And I feel like, how can we really kind of get them together and really make them come out and vote and really, you know, help people see how important it is to have this kind of diversity that we've been talking about for the past 40 minutes?
I think that's a very complex, multifaceted question and answer. But I will say that in my experience, getting people out to vote is bigger than posting a Facebook message about voting. Mm-hmm. It's been really rewarding to see the group of Asian youth that I'm working with engage with electoral reform, mm-hmm. because we're a group of folks who have largely grown up in Vancouver as Asian Canadians. And I think that allowing ourselves to have the space to engage with issues of identity and cultural reclamation and ancestry and history is really, really empowering. Having ourselves speak about these things, mm-hmm. very, very frankly about them together, has been really cool. And I think that's kind of the first, the behind the scenes that we have before we talk about representation, before we talk about electing a woman of color mayor, before we talk about having the first Indigenous mayor, before we, you know, think about these things. I think about different mentorship programs that truly have an intersectional lens, who are led by people who have lived experiences in these things. And I can think of one that I am aware of, and that's the Future Is You and Me. And they're a really rad collective of women of color, very, very queer and trans-friendly, who mentor young folks in particularly arts-based things. And I give all of my praise to them for doing the work that they do, because it's really hard to exist, you know, like that, in spaces like that.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I also feel like being able to vote on your phone might help a lot. I'm not sure why they don't have something in place yet for that at this day and age.
There is kind of the allure of and the drama of right. going to vote physically, though, yeah. right?
But it's kind
I'm
of
a
stressful,
Leo, so I
feel.
Like that.
I have another question. So you were talking a little bit about kind of how exhausting it is to exist as.
You can just stop there. It's just exhausting to exist.
Yeah, it is exhausting to exist. But something I've been like, I don't. I mean, where am I going with this? I just, even for me, like reading the news sometimes feels exhausting. And then like as a woman of color reading the news and like reading about the elections, reading about actually Toronto City Council, their recent election, Faith Goldie, a white nationalist, was running, and she went to my high school. So that was super strange. That is a different conversation entirely, but it was exhausting. And just the thought of like that being so close to home, like, hurt. And you kind of touched upon this, but like, how do we, in organizing, in staying informed about the news, how do we still like take the time and the spaces to like almost, I don't want to say give ourselves a break, but like stay okay and like still be able to engage in meaningful ways without being exhausted all the time?
Still figuring that out. burnout is very, very a large problem in our communities, and particularly within folks who have more intersections in their identities. It is exhausting. but I think that finding a community of folks who understand you, I have a really chill group of friends who I have heart-to-hearts with really frequently. We talk about things like assimilation and growing up in very white spaces and trying to heal from that. So fostering a building space and like a healing space is what I've used. Being with other like-minded folks is sometimes what you need, folks who share your experiences. Yeah.
You know, speaking up. Oh, well, sorry, Alex, you had something to say.
Yeah, like, I would encourage people, if you are feeling really exhausted by this news cycle, to try and engage in some sort of grassroots activism, even if it's just based here in UBC, because that is the most rewarding type of activism, right? Going to a protest, handing out pamphlets, volunteering at a shelter, you can see like the effects of the work that you're doing with the people around you. And yes, that can also be exhausting after a period of time, but I would really encourage people to try and get politically active in ways that may seem small, but actually make a really large change. And I know that in my activist work, that has been the most rewarding for me. And like you said, Kimberly, having that core group of people, whether it be fellow friends and activists, or even a partner or a family member that you can sort of unload to, is really important as well. And I also want to acknowledge that for people like myself who may be suffering from a chronic mental illness or disability, it is fine to also just take some time out of the news and sort of disconnect for a little while as well. I feel, especially in the current political climate, we feel this obligation to continuously be on top of every new issue that is coming out, especially when you are in those activist spaces. So sometimes acknowledging that you can't know it all and fix it all, and taking like a weekend away from your phone and away from some news sites, and then having that minute to pause and regroup and then move forward, can be really useful as well.
Makes me think about existence is resistance. Making sure that you are okay physically and mentally and emotionally is resistance, and is important as staying informed with things online or in the news cycles. Your existence is important.
There's a really famous Chinese book, The Book of War, and it says the first way to win a war is to run away from it. And I think it is important when we're overwhelmed and have feel defeated that we regroup, as you put it. It's a good way to put it, because we need to find our allies and figure out new strategies to go forward. And we need each other to win, but we need to find who's there for us and then figure out how to grow it.
Yeah, I mean, in a similar vein, I didn't grow up in North America, and I grew up in the Middle East, and I was always surrounded by a very large Indian population, and having a voice and being seen was something I think I took for granted growing up in Dubai. And then after coming here, I realized that sort of that role of, you know, activism and making sure you're represented and you're seen, and realizing that, hey, my voice isn't as significant as it should be or as it was while growing up. Yeah, that's definitely something that I think I struggle with every day. So I recognize that need for that space where you can kind of unload, but also take a break and step back, for sure. We're actually pretty close to the end of our show. Does anyone want to say anything? I see Sarah, you have a question?
No, I just wanted to ask to end off, like, where do you see the direction of Vancouver politics, and I guess politics in BC and politics in Canada as a whole, going in the future? Like, what do you hope for it, and where do you think it's going to go?
Blue sky thinking. I hope that our democracies are more representative of the people. I hope that we are able to uncover stories of assimilation and hear things from people like us more. And I hope that, yes, of course, there are more people of color, and particularly women of color, represented in government.
I guess I'm a bit of a pessimist. I think it's because I came from a province that just elected Doug Ford. But I'm personally concerned about the influence of far-right groups in Canadian politics, but I do think that that's just another reason why we have to mobilize, and mobilize in ways that are concretely going to lead to changes in electoral politics?
I'm hoping we'll all go out and organize right up until November 30th and win pro rep so that more more diversity actually is elected. I hope everybody will go to the Women Transforming Cities website and see the 33 issues that the mayor-elect Kennedy Stewart and the majority of people in council have endorsed. And there's lots of great resources on our website, or go to the Hua Foundation website and see what resources they've got there, because there's people. We've also got a Women Friendly Cities Challenge, an online library of wise practices where you can submit wise things that you're doing, and we're trying to get women from all over, self-identified women from all over the world, to share what they're doing so that we can learn from each other, because we don't, there's, you know, you get a lot of power when you hear about other social movements moving around the world. And Professor Crenshaw said that intersectionality must be based in social justice, and I'm quite hopeful about the rising number of people looking for a way to create another kind of world, or the world's not going to be here if we're not getting together with each other and really finding a way forward that reflects all of us.
Mm-hmm. And maybe that is, I guess, the moral in some ways of this whole discussion. As long as we can create that space to support each other and have these conversations, then we don't have to be entirely cynical and pessimistic about the future. I guess that's it. We've reached an end, unfortunately, to today's show. Thank you so much for joining us, Ellen, Kimberly, and Alex, once again. Intersections airs every other Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m. on CITR at 101.9 FM. Make sure you catch us then. Have a wonderful evening, folks.
Thank you for listening to Conversations, a series of live panel discussions hosted by CITR's Spoken Word Collectives. Look out for the next episode on language around disability and accessibility.